is that I want to study the interaction of photons and qubits, where both the photon and the qubit are going to be a superconducting microwave circuit on a chip. So our qubit, in this case, is going to be a superconducting charge qubit, and our photon mode is going to be a transmission line resonator. This system is going to be essentially cavity quantum electrodynamics. And one of the advantages of doing this in circuits is that circuits are very flexible and tunable. Both dynamically, we can change the energy of our atom dynamically, and also lithographically, we can dial in a bunch of parameters when we design the circuits. To give you a flavor of that flexibility, I want to step through three different regimes of cavity QED today by changing some of these parameters. In particular, I'm going to change the energy of our atom and bring the atom in and out of resonance with the cavity to move from the resonant to the dispersive regime. And I'm going to change the strength of the coupling between the atom and the photon to look at what it means to have really strong coupling. And to look at the measurements that we're going to be making are going to be measuring the photon spectrum to see a splitting in the photon spectrum due to the atom, and also to measure the qubit spectrum and to look at the effect that photons have on the qubit spectrum. The last decade has seen quite a large bit of progress in the field of superconducting qubits. There have been many different implementations of a qubit, and they've all been shown to behave basically like a qubit. You can do Rabi and Ramsey oscillations. The coherence times have become longer, though still aren't particularly long, and some two-qubit results are coming out and some gates are starting to come out. But one thing that all of this work has in common is that the electromagnetic fields used in them are mostly classical. You build an atom, you can flip your spin, you can manipulate your atom with a field, but the quantized nature of the field isn't particularly relevant to the problem. It's simply a control parameter that you can treat basically classically. So this is atomic physics. What we hope to do is we hope to make an interaction with quantized fields and really get to the regime of doing quantum optics with circuits. So the system I'm talking about is cavity QED. In the optical world, it looks something like this. You take an atom and you place it between two mirrors, which acts like a cavity. Light bounces back and forth between the mirrors, interacting with the atom many times and giving a much stronger interaction. There are several channels for information to decay out of this system. First, you can have a photon exit the cavity, and we describe this with the decay rate kappa. You can have the excited atom relax back to the ground state. This is characterized by a decay time gamma. And then you can have your atom up and leave the cavity, just walk away, and this is characterized by some kind of transit time. We say we're in the strong coupling regime when the interaction between the atom and the photon is fast compared with all of these various decay channels. This means that the atom can absorb and re-emit the same photon multiple times before losing the information. This system can be described by a fairly simple Hamiltonian. It's about the simplest interaction between a boson and a fermion you could imagine. There's a first term, which is a harmonic oscillator. This is the harmonic oscillator on the photon. The second term is a spin one-half system. To a good approximation, we can ignore the higher energy levels of our atom and think of it merely as a spin one-half system. And then there's this flip-flop term, which gives you the ability to absorb one quanta of energy from the photon by the atom, or vice versa. And so we're going to look at what this Hamiltonian does. But what we'd like to do is we'd like to implement this Hamiltonian not here with an atom and mirrors, but with a circuit. So first we need a means of confining photons to a circuit. And the way you can do this is with a transmission line, in our case, a coplanar waveguide. You can think of this essentially as a flattened version of a coaxial cable, where radiation travels down the center pin and there's ground planes on either side. Now, in order to make a transmission line into a cavity, we need to introduce mirrors. The circuit equivalent of a mirror is just a capacitor, and so you can see we've put gaps in the center pin at either end. This length controls the frequency. It's a Fabry-Perot cavity. We can tune the value of these capacitances to change the Q of our cavity, and we can bring the Q anywhere from 50 to 100 up to about a million. So we have a very large range in which we can tune the Q of the cavity. Now, we want this to interact with an atom, so at a voltage antinode, we define a superconducting circuit, in this case, a Cooper pair box. And we're going to study the interaction between these two. I should point out also that our Cooper pair box has yet to get up and walk away, and so the transit time mode of decoherence is completely gone. It's really there. So But this is what a close-up view of what the Cooper pair box looks like. I don't want to say too much about what it is, except that we have two superconducting islands that are separated by Josephson junctions. And this essentially has two states, one with some large number of Cooper pairs on this island, and one with one extra Cooper pair on the island. We can treat this as a spin one-half system. And the important point that I want to get across is that we can dynamically tune the energy of this system, both by applying a gate voltage, which is a start shift, a sigma x shift, and we can change the actual energy of the qubit with an applied magnetic field by threading flux through this loop. Because we're dealing with the extra Cooper pair is on this horizontal thing that's an island. These two squares here are Josephson junctions. So it's in between, it's anywhere along here. These junctions are on top. So this horizontal line is a continuous piece of metal. And I should point out that the thing on top here is the center pin of the resonator, and this is the ground pin of the resonator. So the way we get an interaction between the Cooper pair box and the resonator is that this displaced Cooper pair essentially acts like a dipole. And because this distance here is on the order of a micron, the dipole that we get is significantly larger than the dipole that you get in simply an atomic scale distance, a factor of about 10 to the fourth times as large. In addition, because we're not dealing with a free space waveguide, but actually a transmission line, we get significantly enhanced field densities. The distance between the center pin and the ground plane is a very small fraction of a wavelength. And so putting all of this together, we get couplings that are on the order of 1,000 to 1,000,000 times stronger than the couplings you can get for real atoms, which is a good thing because our decoherence times are much shorter, and so we need this added coupling. So when we add all of this together, we get a circuit that looks something like this. We have a long, squiggly transmission line, and you can see the aspect ratio of this is really quite thin. This thing is about 15 millimeters long, and the gap here that you see is 5 microns. Also, this is a zoom in at the end. This is the type of capacitor we make in order to tune the Q. This is for a cavity with a Q of about 10,000. So we want to analyze this, and the natural place to start is to look at what happens when the qubit and the cavity are resonant with each other. So I'm going to describe these various regimes. So this is a transmission line. A zoom in of this actually, as a cross section, has a ground plane, a gap, a center pin, a gap, and a ground plane. This is a view of the end of that circuit. So you can see this here is the center pin, and it has a capacitor to another center pin. And then we place the Cooper pair box in the middle at a voltage antinode. The purpose of the squiggles is actually just to add path length. If you make the radius of curvature large enough, then you don't notice the squiggles in your electrical evaluation, and you can fit stuff on a smaller chip. This would be sort of a really long and difficult to work with chip otherwise. So what does it mean to be resonant? The way I'm going to describe the various regimes is with this phase diagram here, where on the vertical axis I'm going to plot the coupling normalized to the largest source of decoherence in the problem. And on the horizontal axis, I'm going to plot the detuning between the atom and the cavity. So to be resonant means that your atom and cavity are basically the same frequency to within roughly the order of the strength of the coupling. I said before, strong means that G has to be bigger than all the sources of decoherence. So in this picture, strong means that G has to be greater than 1. So pretty much everything I've drawn here is in the resonant strong coupling regime. So what kind of dynamics can we expect from the resonant regime? Well, let's look at transmission through the cavity in the absence of a qubit first. In the absence of a cavity, the energy level diagram is very simple. We have a harmonic oscillator, so going up the left side, I've written the number of photons in the cavity, and these are equally spaced by the resonator frequency. We want to probe this, and so we can probe this with a transmission measurement. We apply microwave frequencies to one end of our cavity, and we measure the transmission amplitude and phase coming out the other side, and we see a single peak with width kappa. This corresponds to this energy scale right here. So now, when we bring our qubit into the problem, we're going to now have a degenerate system because our qubit and our cavity are resonant. And I'm going to plot the energy level diagram like this, where on the left I'll plot the qubit in the ground state, and on the right I'm going to plot the qubit in the excited state. So now, because the qubit and cavity are resonant, this the one photon ground state is degenerate with the zero photon excited state. But there's an interaction term which is going to cause a splitting, and this degeneracy is listed by twice the interaction rate G. So I'm going to apply transmission to try and study this, and indeed, instead of seeing one peak, we see two peaks. This is what's known as the vacuum-Rabi splitting. And these two peaks in this picture are separated by a G by 12 megahertz, corresponding to a G of 6 megahertz. You can think of these peaks as two peaks corresponding to a single excitation mode that's shared between the photon and the qubit. So this peak would be qubit plus photon, and this peak would be qubit minus photon. Now, in more recent experiments, we've really wanted to push this coupling much stronger. So this is a vacuum-Rabi coupling data for a G of 120 megahertz. This splitting is now 240 megahertz. So the splitting is now 4% of the energy of our photon. So this is an incredibly large splitting. And just to show you what happens as we tune this in and out of resonance, this is tuning with the magnetic field the energy of the atom, and this is plotting frequency along the vertical axis. So this this curve here is a vertical slice through this picture. Way out in the left and right, the wings, you see a single qubit, a single resonator and the qubit frequencies, and as we bring them into resonance, we can see this vacuum-Rabi avoided crossing. Here, I should note that the peaks are very wide. We've purposefully made them wide in order to get much better signal to noise so we can get this good color picture, but we can actually do this with much smaller width. Yeah. Oh, sorry, the Z is measuring transmission amplitude, so it's simply plotting this transmission in the Z-axis. The qubit, you can always add more Cooper pairs, and so the qubit, the qubit is definitely never a two-level system, but the Cooper pair, the next highest energy level is far away because you have this Josephson energy and the charging energy, and depending on where you work in parameter space, this next transition frequency is anywhere from 20 to, you know, two times as large as your omega 0-1. So you really can get this frequency. You really have sufficient anharmonicity to completely ignore this higher order level. Now, if we want to actually use this as a means of reading out our qubit, then resonance is not exactly where we want to be, because these states are now completely mixed photon and atom states. And so if we put one photon through, we're going to cause our atom to change its spin. And we can't do repeated measurements of the same atom without causing it to flip all around. And so what we'd really like to do is we'd like to move to a place where the qubit is mostly a qubit and the atom is mostly an atom. The atom and the cavity are mostly qubit and cavity, with only a very, very small amount of mixing. So they can still detect each other. They can still feel each other's presence. But the wave functions have very little overlap. And we can do that by controlling this horizontal axis on the phase diagram, by detuning the cavity. The degree of mixing, that the degree of overlap that the wave functions have is G over delta squared. So this line that I've drawn with G equal to 10, delta over 10 is a 1% qubit photon mixing line. So if we had a QND measurement, being to the right of this line would allow more than 100 repeated measurements of the atom without flipping the spin. And so this is what we're going to call the dispersive regime. And this green region is sort of a crossover between resonant and dispersive. And you can call it whatever you want. So in the dispersive regime, we can diagonalize our Hamiltonian approximately and see that our interaction term goes from a flip-flop term to a product of a sigma z and an a dagger a. This is a really nice, convenient Hamiltonian because it commutes with this term commutes with the other terms in the Hamiltonian, which means it is, to the extent that this Hamiltonian is accurate, which is in G squared over delta, this means that this is a QND measurement, which means that we can actually measure our qubit using our photons without absorbing any energy. One way to think about this is to think about a cavity. If I had a perfectly transmitting piece of glass, absolutely no absorption, and I stuck it in the cavity, you could tell that I put the piece of glass in the cavity because the frequency would shift. I'm inserting an index of refraction, a phase delay, without actually absorbing any energy. And this is how you should think about this this qubit term. Notice I've grouped it here with the resonator. So you can think of this as a qubit-dependent shift in the frequency of the cavity. It's an omega r plus something that depends on the spin of the qubit. So if we have our bare resonator frequency at omega r, this is plotting transmission, and we look at what happens when we have a spin down qubit, it shifts the cavity to the left by g squared over delta. And if we look at what happens when we have an up qubit, it shifts the cavity to the right by g squared over delta. So this gives us a 2g squared over delta splitting. We can measure our qubit by applying a tone directly in the middle, and we'll either see a phase that is high or low, depending on which peak we're on. So we get the same amplitude out in either case of measurement, but the phase is different. So our information is now going to be carried in the phase. So to do these measurements, we're going to want two tones now. We're going to have one tone that is sitting here at the bare resonator frequency, measuring the phase of the qubit. And we're now going to introduce a second tone, which is a control tone, which is going to be at the qubit frequency, which is now detuned by about a gigahertz. And we're going to flip the qubit around. And so you can see here that when we take our qubit and we apply a 2-pi pulse at the qubit transition frequency, we see no change in the signal of our phase coming out of our cavity. But when we apply a pi pulse or a 3-pi pulse, we see a big jump and then a slow decay. This decay decays with order T1, and so we can now do this continuously, plotting phase in the z direction as a function of the pulse length and the time after the pulse, and we can see these Rabi oscillations. We can do Rabi, Ramsey, and all the typical pulse things, which I don't want to get into too much detail on. Our record T1 is about 7 or 8 microseconds, and our record T2 is still only about 500 nanoseconds. But I want to talk a little more about what's going on with this measurement, and in particular, I've said that this is a QND measurement, which means we're not going to induce any spin flips as a result of this. But we are going to have some back action. This measurement is not without effect on the qubit. And you can see this by putting the same interaction term. This is the exact same Hamiltonian I wrote before, but grouped differently. You can put this interaction term now with the qubit, and you can see that there's a start shift of the qubit by your applied radiation. Depending on the number of photons in the cavity, you're going to shift the peak over by some amount. And the start shift is going to be 2g squared over delta per photon. So if we measure the peak with one photon and the peak with 20 photons, we see that it's gone from this frequency, and it's shifted over by the amount we expect, which is 2g squared over delta. But you also notice something else has happened. The peak has gotten fat. We've introduced the source of dephasing in it. You might be surprised, or not, depending on whether you're an NMR person. But the way you can think about this is you have a single Lorentzian line shape, which corresponds to your qubit peak. Now, if we put in actually a number state, if we actually managed to put a Fock state in our cavity, we would simply shift this peak over by the start shift. But what we put in is not a coherent state. We put in a coherent state, which has some shot noise in the coherent state. It has some width to it. And so actually what we see is the sum of a bunch of Lorentzians, which give us an overall Gaussian line shape in the limit of large n, with width that goes as the square root of n. So we have this shot noise of the measurement, which gives us some broadening to our qubit line. Now, you could ask the question, is there a definition of strong in the dispersive regime where our interaction strength, g squared over delta, the start shift per photon, becomes much larger than all decoherent sources in the problem? In this case, then these lines would no longer blur together. And this is what we call the strong dispersive regime. So I can plot this line on the phase diagram I've been showing to you. And now this line corresponds to g squared over delta, the start shift per photon, being equal to the largest source of decoherence in the problem. And now you can start to see the real power of circuit QED, because other QED systems, the Rydberg and Adams, are right at the edge of this, and they can start to see some of this physics. But they can't get really, really strongly into this region. They don't quite have the coupling strength to get into here. But in our system, we can just make our capacitor larger. And by making a larger capacitor, we can tune ourselves well into the strong dispersive regime. So when we measure the qubit spectrum in the strong dispersive regime, what do we see? Rather than seeing a single qubit peak, we see the qubit spectrum resolve into many peaks. These correspond to 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, photons in the cavity. So we can read out the number of photons in the cavity, or at least because we're averaging over many cycles, we can get a distribution of the number of photons in the cavity. Now, this is taken for a particular drive power. So we're populating the cavity with some kind of coherent tone and measuring the qubit spectrum. You'll notice that it's peaked around n equals 1 or 2. This corresponds to the average photon number in the cavity. So if we wanted to, we could think, what would this do as we varied the photon number in the cavity? with a coherent drive. And you can indeed see the evolution of a coherent state from a single peak where we have essentially no photons in the cavity to larger and larger peaks, and at the top it becomes essentially Gaussian. And we can push this out and really look at the statistics of the photons in the cavity in terms of the probability of having a certain photon number. This is all nice. You can also look at something else, which is different types of distribution. So suppose instead we put a thermal state and a coherent state into the cavity with the same number of photons in each distribution. Here we create the thermal state not by heating the cavity, because we don't want our qubit to get hot, but by applying white noise that's broad, or noise that's white on the width of the cavity. And this can be shown to produce the same distribution as actually raising the temperature. And so you can see there's a very obvious qualitative difference between these two states, where this closely matches the decaying exponential you'd expect for a thermal distribution, and this detects the peaked Poissonian statistics you'd expect for a coherent state. So you really can get a good idea of what the number of photons in the cavity is and what kind of distribution it has. Now, what does this say about photons as a quantum information resource? The thing that I think is most interesting is thinking about what this means for conditional logic. Suppose we apply a pi pulse now on the one photon peak here. This means that we're going to cause a flip in our qubit only if there's one photon in the cavity. So this is a conditional logic now, where we can use the number of photons in the cavity as the thing that we're conditioning our logic on. So if we had two qubits on opposite ends of the cavity, we coherently swapped one qubit into the cavity, and then applied this one photon pi pulse on the other qubit, then we've done a controlled not gate from one qubit to another qubit. So you can really do conditional logic using the photons as a medium. This really gives you photons as a quantum resource in superconducting circuits. I should point out that very similar results have been seen in the motional states of ion traps. They can look at the statistics of that particular mode. And I think this is very promising, because motional states and ion traps have turned out to be quite a useful quantum resource there. And I think this looks to say that photons could maybe be an analogous quantum resource in our experiments. I think that's where I want to wrap up. I just want to say that this has shown that we do have a really good system for studying cavity QED here, where we can interact a superconducting atom and a superconducting resonator, and have good control over the various parameters of the problem, so we can push to new regimes of cavity QED. And the things I've shown you just quickly are the vacuum Rabi splitting with a very large vacuum Rabi splitting, the dispersive measurement of the qubit coherence, the Rabi fringes, Rabi oscillations, and of course now the resolving the single photon states in the resonance. Thank you.